This is the Hollywood Outsider, a weekly movie and TV podcast, which can be found at thehollywoodoutsider.com. We've got a new episode every week. This is a special episode, so hang tight. Be sure to get the Hole in the Go with our Apple or Android apps. You can also find us on iTunes, where reviews are appreciated, Spotify, iHeartRadio, TuneIn Radio, Stitcher, or your podcast app of choice. Please share the show with your friends on your social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Reddit, MySnap, SnapFace, whatever the hell it is these days the kids are using. Please share us on there. That's always a help. My name is Aaron Peterson. I'm your host for The Hollywood Outsider, and like I said, this is a special episode. This week, we're currently off, but we didn't want to just leave you hanging. And I told you on the previous episode that there was something kind of special coming out that I hope you guys would check out. So it is. So you might have heard, we just had an interview with the director that just aired before this of Zoom, so you can definitely check that out. But this is kind of a really cool interview I'm taking from another podcast I do. Now, The Blacklist Exposed is a podcast I do with Troy, and Troy Heinrichs. He's been on our show before. And what we do over there is we talk about the show, the TV show, The Blacklist. And just recently, it was actually a couple months ago, so you might hear some dated references as you listen to it. But a couple months ago, we had authors Tara Bennett and Paul Terry on. You might wonder, why do we have authors on? Well, they are the ones that are responsible for doing the fan collection books, the in-world books that so many of us really love for our favorite TV shows and movies, say, like the Lost Encyclopedia or Fringe's September Notebook, those sorts of things. They're the ones that work with the studios to put these together to sell to you guys so you have a fancy bitchin' collectible on your nightstand and or your trophy case, wherever you may keep it. So this interview actually spawned from that, and I wanted to share it with you because I thought it was very cool, and it times itself to something of theirs that just came out, which is the Big Trouble in Little China collection. And it's really cool. I mean, we brought them on to talk about the Blacklist Dossier, which is a book like September's Notebook or Lost Encyclopedia that they did for the Blacklist. And it spiraled into all kinds of things. We talk about Fringe's September Notebook. We talk about the Lost Encyclopedia. And we definitely talk about the Big Trouble in Little China book, which, of course, if you've ever listened to the show, you know Kurt Russell is my guy. He's my soulmate. He doesn't know it. He hasn't gotten the memo, and the paperwork isn't really... Well, I mean, there's a restraining order, is what I'm trying to say. But he knows. Deep in his mind, he knows. And this is one of those movies that is very, very near and dear to my heart, and I just can't wait to get this book and dive into it. I love these collectibles. These are very cool, and I hope you guys enjoy this interview. Now, keep in mind, it's taken from another podcast, which is The Blacklist Exposed. You can find that at theblacklistexposed.com. If you are a Blacklist fan, keep an eye on that, because we're going to have star Megan Boone is actually going to be on our show September 17th. Until then, listen to this cool interview. It's nice to every once in a while get a feel for people that aren't in front of the camera or aren't holding the camera, but still have something directly to do with the shows and movies that we love. And I think it's a very cool interview, and these are really great people, and I hope you enjoy it. Also want to mention Remake This Movie Right. Lots of new episodes there. We've got another one coming up with screenwriter S.S. Wilson. And we just had Jason Kabasi from The Walking Dead cast. And we've got Michael R. from Den of Geek. There's a lot of cool stuff coming up on there. So please definitely check that out. That's RemakeThisMovieWrite.com. And one last one is Beyond Westworld. If you're a fan of Westworld, Troy and I just launched a podcast for Beyond Westworld. It's basically going to cover HBO's Westworld. For the time being, we're kind of going through that TV show, and eventually, I'm guessing Tara Bennett and Paul Terry are going to do a book for Westworld too. So go to beyondwestworldpodcast.com or just find us in your podcast app of choice, Beyond Westworld. Okay, I think that does it. Let's get into the interview. I hope you guys enjoy it. This is my interview with Tara Bennett and Paul Terry, writers of The Blacklist Dossier, Big Trouble in Little China, Lost Encyclopedia, and Fringe, September's Notebook.
Hi, it's Megan Boone, and you're listening to Blacklist Exposed on Golden Spiral Media.
Well, hey, Blacklist Fandom Nation, Troy and Aaron back again with a special interview. Some of you might not need any introduction to these people, because if you're a fan of shows like Lost and Alias and Fringe like I am, we've only talked about it like every time on every podcast that we've done up to this point.
You've talked about it. I've on talked every about podcast. It, yes, yes.
You might know the names Paul Terry and Tara Bennett. They do some very creative things when it comes to, you know, extensions of shows, in-world books, things that just kind of expand the universe of the shows that we love. And they have done a in-world book for The Blacklist. literally written in the first person, almost as Elizabeth Keen herself, kind of a dossier of things that have happened in her life. We welcome to the program now, Paul and Tara. Hey guys, how are you all doing this evening?
Very good, thank you. How are you?
Thanks so much for having us. We're happy, happy, happy to be here.
Oh, that's like super happy.
Yes.
Why don't we just start with an easy question? What inspired you guys to just be writers in the first place?
Oh, a nice easy one. Is that Tara, you go first.
Well, I started out as a TV producer, actually on the East Coast of the United States. I loved writing as a kid, but I wanted to be in television. So I did that after I graduated, and I ended up doing a lot of writing for, you know, my college studies and then writing scripts when I was doing television things. And I then actually, way back in the early days of broadband, I started doing movie reviews for the local site that I worked for. I worked with Comcast for a really long time. I did it on the side, and in around 2003, I had a downsizing from the TV side of what I was doing, but I'd been writing on the side for about 4 years. And I made that one of those big choices to go, all right, do I want to write or do I want to produce? And based on the kind of television that you produce on the East Coast, which is mostly political and public affairs, I decided to make the jump and see if I could get into magazines, and I did. And Titan Magazines, which is also the publisher of our Blacklist book, Titan Books. Paul was my editor for Alias Magazine. I got into the Buffy the Vampire Slayer magazine and then wrote...
You know, you did that too? I read that.
And I loved Buffy. Buffy was like my favorite show. And
yeah, I just squeed. I did.
Oh, that's awesome, because I love when I hear other fans. And then I wrote for Angel, and then Paul was doing Alias, and that is how I started working with him. He was my boss for the run of that. And then at that time, around 2003, I just jumped in whole hog, and that's pretty much why I've been writing since. It's just so much fun, and it wasn't where I thought I'd start when I graduated college, but it's certainly been my favorite career path so far.
Nobody's where they want to be when they graduate college.
Like, I'm not grown up. I don't know what I want to exactly do. I'm just going to do this right now because it's awesome.
Exactly. And what about you, Paul?
Well, if my mum was listening, she would say, you know, it goes back to when he was making his own comics with his hands, you know, as a kid. I used to like writing a lot of short stories and drawing my own comic panels. So I think maybe the idea of just telling stories started way back then. But similar to Tara, you know, I was at college and I really got into working for my student magazine and ended up editing one of the entertainment sections there and doing different kind of reviews for movies and music and things like that. And then I started out in the publishing world properly when I graduated as an editor. And my first magazine was the official Lego magazine.
Mm.
You know, Lego is like a crazy hot property now, and it's always been a hot property, but back then it wasn't so much, I guess, in the public, you know, the pop culture consciousness, because, you know, I remember the Star Wars Lego launching during that magazine time. So that was my first gig.
Oh, so you were there before it like went to the next level. You were there when Legos were still that thing you jammed in your brother's mouth when he was pissing you off, right?
It was like, I remember going through, like, you know, back and forth with for the launch of the Harry Potter Lego for us to do the features on that in the magazine. So that's how far back, you know, my stuff goes. But then shortly after Lego, as Tara was explaining, I joined Titan Magazines as an editor and worked on a bunch of titles as an editor, including, you know, Simpsons comics, Futurama comics. And in the kind of like TV world, Alias Magazine was one of mine, and Lost, the official Lost magazine followed that, and that kind of dovetailed beautifully into doing the Lost Encyclopedia, which is my first book proper with Tara. So my freelance time was much more focused on, you know, doing these kind of big year-long book projects. And I just kind of got the taste of that and thought, these are really satisfying, they're really creative, and it's been that way for a while now.
Yeah.
And you score films too, right? Or you have?
Yes, I still do that. Yeah, it's far too many plates spinning above my head. But I've always been like that since being a kid, so I think it's just comes naturally. But yeah, I always use that phrase of, when I'm not writing books, I'm writing music. Yeah, I've done a bunch of independent films and got a few projects out here, which I can't talk about just yet, but lots of cool, fun things on the go. And I do a solo project called Telescope, which I've been recording under for just over 10 years. Yeah, writing music and writing books, that's kind of my two main passions.
Wow. So what got you both into the expanded universe content for television? I mean, for those expanded worlds?
I guess Lost was the first like taste into it, I guess.
Yeah, or, I mean, I had done 24, the companion guides, and those are making of. So, you know, it's if you're a fan of 24 and wanted to know how those seasons unfolded from the actor's perspective, that's what I did. But I guess, you know, because we'd worked so closely with ABC on the Lost magazine, and they didn't allow a lot of writers on that because obviously the secrecy of that show was a little crazy. So I was the one that went out on the set. Oh, so sad for me. In a way. And of course, you know, Paul was the one that he had all the access. I mean, I didn't have access to scripts. He did because he had to write the magazine. And then they realized anybody was going to be allowed to kind of create a book that would come out really close to when the series finished, it should be the people they already trusted and, you know, knew not to talk about anything. So they went to Paul and basically said, I think it might be too big for one person. And he went, yeah. And he was so gracious and came to me and said, you know, could you do this with me? And I was like, yeah.
Tara's being far too polite and far too kind. Basically, I said to DK, who published it, I said, well, yeah, this is definitely a two-person gig, but there's literally only one other person who can do this with me. And that wasn't me talking in hyperbole. It's because Tara, as she was saying, had the trust and the access of the show, as she was my lead writer for the magazine. So there was no other choice. It was, and I hung up from DK and I phoned Tara and I said, DK, going to phone you. Just say yes. Just say you'll do it. She's like, what? I mean, just say yes. And then I hung up. And then that's literally how it went down. But, but as Tara was rightly saying, you know, that show, it's such an amazing show, but we were crafting the book whilst the last season was in production. So, you know, that the level of trust that the Bad Robot and ABC had with us had to kind of like go up a level because we had to know what was going on towards, you know, the end of the show.
Yeah, we knew the end of the show before it aired because we had to finish the book.
It wasn't even like a special, it was a lovely special treat, but it wasn't like, oh, we're so cool, we knew it. We just had to for the book. Yeah. So we were we're very, very grateful and lucky to be in that, you know, the small circle of trust. And Noreen O'Toole was, you know, it's really our third amigo on that project for many years.
She was a producer on the show, and she was a huge advocate for us. And yeah, so that book came out, and it was in World because they didn't want, you know, the magazine was kind of the making of the show. I mean, it was all the interviews with cast and with the writers, and so they didn't really want to repeat it because they, you know, were doing it, you know, bi-monthly with that magazine. So that's how the encyclopedic part of it. And so it was written like all the people existed, all the props existed, you know, the plane existed, everything was written in that kind of very precise, it's as somebody was telling you the story of it as it really happened.
Like historical kind of, like a historical document saying like the island was this, the island did this. And
so you guys knew how Lost was going to end before it actually ended?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You know, I had known with 24 because when I was doing those books, I was also writing them when they were doing seasons. With Lost, you know, they trust us enough because already the scripts, you know, had been for years given to Paul. And if I had to know something, I certainly found out when I was talking to actors because there was always long lead interviews. So they just knew that we knew how to shut up. You know, it's more important for us to have a work than for us to talk about it. You know,
absolutely. So. And to qualify that, you know, we're not talking like a year before. We're talking pretty close to the end, but
that's still a tough secret to try. Even though, I mean, in that show specifically,
we always joked about this. And there was in the UK, it was airing on Sky, and I was doing the fan supporting show for that called The Lost Initiative with Ian Lee and Tom Page, and there was this amazing wave of relief when that aired simultaneously with the States, and it went out I think 5 a.m. in the UK when I sort of processed as the credits rolled that everyone around the world knew and had seen the end of Lost. It was like, okay, fine. Everyone's on the same page. I don't have to worry about this anymore.
No accidental talking about anything. Yeah.
Because as Tara was saying with the scripts, the way that had to work was I would read the script and then it would get, you know, double, triple, quadruple deleted from all of my systems. I never had, you know, I never wanted a physical copy. And so, you know, friends would say, you know, at socials and parties and stuff, go, but oh, I reckon if we get a couple of beers in you might say something. And I was going, you know me better than that. I'm like a trained, methodical robot of just compartmentalization. There, you cannot get an inch out of me on the show. And that was the safest way to do it. No, friends and family don't have a clue, and that's the way I like it.
You know, from that, I actually pitched the Fringe September's Notebook to Jeff Pinkner, who was from Alias and Lost and had gone on, you know, to executive produce Fringe. I just said, you know, I sent him a copy of the encyclopedia and said, Jeff, I want you to have this, you know, because when he had left Lost in the early seasons, I just said, you know, so you can have it as a yearbook. But, you know, if you ever wanted to do something with Fringe, and this is the first time I've ever pitched a book. And they turned around and said yes. And so we came up with the concept because, you know, they didn't want to do a behind the scenes book for that either. And we pretty quickly had thought, you know, September is such a really cool omniscient character that kind of comes in and out. There's so much we haven't seen of him, but maybe he's been watching the whole time. And so we pitched that to Jeff and Joel Wyman, who was the other executive producer at the time. And they both said, yep. And then that was really cool because, again, that was another book that was being written while they, when they found out they had the last fifth season, we were writing it while they were giving us scripts. And then Joel, you know, really loved the idea of The Notebook and then put it in the series, which, like, the two of us lost our minds. We were like, wait, you want to put it in the series? And he goes, yeah, why wouldn't you? I mean, this is all the stuff that he's been doing. It makes sense that he'd be, like, collecting all of this. And then we just were like, oh, my God. So that was, like, an out-of-this-world experience to actually see it in the very end of the run of the series. Once we kind of were in a circle or registered, oh, you know, you guys, one, are really trustworthy, and you've worked on some really highly confidential properties, and you guys, you know, have good ideas and can come with, you know, things that we can do that would be great for the fans. Cause we always approach it that we're fans.
Totally.
You know, if we love something, we don't want somebody buying something that they're going to feel like they got cheated, you know, like that's the worst. I mean, I've bought plenty of books where I adore something and maybe it just didn't really feel like it was written by somebody that cared that much. It kind of feels like they just had to do it or it was a corporate exercise. And Paul and I have always said, you know, we're a little nutty with how much we desperately want to make sure that it's a value to a fan, that it doesn't feel like that we shorted out on trying to really give somebody, if they love a show enough, that they can walk away with something that they can always flip over and smile and look at it and remember all the things that they love about the show. And so that's kind of how, you know,
it's kind of a mandate, isn't it? To trap the show itself in the book, but also try and surprise, if we can, that, you know, a fan coming to it would go, oh, I didn't expect it to be from that perspective or that angle or that amount of detail for this certain area of the show. And we get more satisfaction from that because, you know, we're fans first. So if we feel like we've got this fan value, if we'd buy it, like Tara was saying.
Yeah, and for The Blacklist, Titan Books was the European distributor for Fringe September's Notebook. And they were really impressed by that book. It's not to know, you know, they just liked it. And so they had wanted us to do something like that, hopefully for another one of their licenses. And they had pitched the Johns, The Blacklist, that book. And once they saw it, they said, yeah, that this is what we'd like to do for The Blacklist. And so that's how, you know, that kind of book came to being Elizabeth Keene's Dossier.
Wow.
It was really cool because I sat in John's office, I think it was back in March out there in LA, and he literally handed it to me. He's like, Troy, look at this thing. It's like, is this something you'd buy? Is this cool or what? And I was just amazed at the level of detail inside of the dossier itself. Just with even the different tabs and how it was actually made to look like a file folder, just that level of detail is really, really impressive.
Oh,
that's really lovely to hear. That, thank you for passing that on. That's super great.
Yeah, because, you know, what we were trying to do is, one, we didn't want to repeat ourselves. We really loved that Titan and the Johns appreciated Fringe's Notebook, but we certainly didn't want for fans to feel like, oh, well, I'm just getting another one of these. So it was really, really important for us to think about, well, why in the world would Liz do this? And so, you know, Paul came up with a really great idea because he fights the internet sometimes. He tries to use the internet, but try to have a life outside of it.
Tara's being too kind again. I love analog. I love, it's like, put it this way, whenever J.J. Abrams tweets out like a postcard with a handwritten message on it, like, that gives me all the kind of, yes, that's all the feels. It's all the analog feels. It's like embracing technology in an analog backwards way. I love it. So what felt really fun about this project was that we've seen, as fans of the show, as you guys have seen as well, how unstable and easily penetrable the digital world is, even to, you know, the post office and stuff like that. So we were racking our brains one day, and then it naturally popped in there, the idea that, well, if Liz is in this complete bind of a scenario with who to trust, having an analog, you know, hard copy written down dossier that collects copies of certain files or things she snapped, you know, pictures of, all clandestine, and had this kept in a physical tome that she kept safe somewhere, almost like it's her failsafe if anything else goes down. That's kind of how the genesis of the intro to the book came from. It was like saying to the fans, this is exactly why, for a narrative reason, why Liz has done this dossier, rather than looking at the world as digital it is. It's like, that's what an agent would have to resort to, maybe, is go back to the hard copy.
Yeah, and it really nicely dovetailed into this season when, you know, she had to go on the run, and it made even more sense why she would, you know, be collecting and trying, you know, have something to basically try to explain how she was going
with the cabal,
to, with the cabal, how she was going to, in any kind of way, defend or explain what had happened. And so what was really nice is they decided to let us into the writer's circle with getting access. You know, of course, they start writing the show in the summer before it starts airing again in the fall. And so we were able to work with Nicole Phillips, who is really fantastic.
She's
in the
awesome.
Writer's room. And she writes the comics for the book, for the series.
Yeah, we've talked to Nicole before. She's great.
So, you know how great she is. And so she worked with us, making sure that we were getting the most recent scripts, you know, because obviously that show makes a lot of changes and a lot of, you know, edits and rewrites and such. So we really worked with her to liaise to make sure that, you know, we were, what were the conceits that we could do that would allow story points up to the mid-season for this last season, up for the break, to the winter break, because at some point we have to lock the book so it goes away to go get printed, but still make it feel vital. You know, we didn't want it to be on the run cabal and be out in stores and everybody go, well, you know, that was a while ago. This, you know, all this other stuff has happened. And so we really crunch every time we get a script and figured out, you know, it would be those additional things that we're kind of put in the back in that pocket.
Yeah, there's some really fun, even beyond the back pocket, if you look at the book again. If you look at anything from the season 3 era onwards, the way that Liz has collated information is much more on the fly.
Yeah.
So it's much more like quickly written down on scrappy bits of paper from things like the cafe, almost like she's holding onto those to put back in the dossier, the kind of off-screen dossier at some point that we haven't seen, even where that dossier exists or lives. But that was our big sort of motivation to get as sort of in-world as we could with that, from that character.
Yeah, from the break, mid-season break, when it returned in the winter and then went to the end, you know, there's been all kinds of other twists and turns that, you know, don't necessarily dovetail specifically into her being on the run. But we were really proud that a lot of the stuff that we had kind of dialed in from what we'd read in scripts and stuff still stayed.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
We would hate to have a book come out and go like, oh, that's ruined.
They just changed everything. That sucks.
And we're like, oh. So, yeah, we were really happy that, because we had kind of been swimming in Blacklist so thoroughly that we stayed broad enough, but yet also just wove in a lot of specifics, we feel, that like still kind of really does tie it in without anybody having to feel like, oh, I don't know if that fits.
Absolutely. And Nicole was great for that. And, you know, she was liaising back to, you know, the Johns and making sure that, checking out the details for anything that's moving ahead, that in case we, even just some of the nuances of how we had Liz do her handwritten commentaries on some of the case files.
Yeah.
Was just really good to get advice on how far to go with something. Might be related to Tom, maybe, some of those sections. Maybe we'll go and read some Tom stuff. It was just a really great communication, a great collaboration with the show on that respect.
So did you guys actually get then Megan's handwriting to kind of mirror what her handwriting would look like for the book?
It's tricky when you do. It's a bit like the September's Notebook thingy. It's those moments of typography, and I'm such a font nerd, I could bore you for hours on fonts. But we collaborated mainly with the publisher and the design team, who were Amazing 15, who are also doing our Big Trouble book. They basically presented a bunch of different handwritten style fonts that would look, from a female perspective, which is almost impossible to lay out, but also legible. It's really crucial when you have that much handwritten copy in a book that it doesn't look like it's repeating, like it could be typed up. It also has, you know, a legibility and a believability that is from a character. And that's kind of the thrust of anything when you have like a handwritten, massive handwritten element to it.
Yeah, because if we had tried to, you know, have her write out a page and then repeat that, usually people's handwriting doesn't look good on a page when it's actually laid out kind of like a font. So
it's a weird question.
We did that a ton with September's. Holy cow, did we look for the right handwritten font for that for a very long
and,
time.
And, you know, JJ and the producer on that show, you know, they're all big font nerds as well, which is, was music to our ears. And we're like, this is great because we get to all nerd out about what is the, exactly the right, should it be, how much of a serif should it be?
Yeah.
Like, what's the angles of, like, the eye towels and stuff? So it's... And it's like I warned you, it's boring.
It's exciting. You know, I've designed websites before, so I mean, I know how it is to just spend all day trying to get it right. Yeah,
yeah. It's another glimpse of how much we like to deep dive these properties. I guess is even down to the font.
Yeah.
Well, and it totally works too, because as I'm looking through it the other day, I'm just like, wow, that you almost can get the sense of she's like scribbling on these yellow note cards as they go throughout the book. And you'd sit there and go, did she actually write some of this for you guys? Because you wonder if her handwriting looks like this, because it is just so, it's literally completely, what's the word I'm looking for?
Cursive? I don't know.
it contradicts, you know, the regular writing and the stuff that's actually like the printed stuff and coming from the case files. So it really stands out really nicely.
That's really great to hear. Here's another little nerdy thing which me and Tara spent far too many hours discussing was we realized with even the Blacklist case files, you know, there's a lot of members of staff at the post office, and we were saying to each other, well, you know, we should try and come up with a bunch of different, slightly different tones of typing, talking through those files, and also slightly different font treatments for the Blacklist files so that it feels like they've not all been written by one person.
Yeah, we wanted to make it feel really like somebody from the post office, a mixture, and you weren't quite sure who it was, but each one is written in a different style.
Yeah.
So repeatable, but they're all different. Some people are like extraordinarily like fact-based, and some people are fact-based but have a little bit more of a warm
of a
style.
Jazz.
Yeah, exactly. So we kind of wanted people to kind of guess who they could be, like, well, when you read it, who the post office might have written this way.
Yeah, was it you know, a main cast member, main character, or was it like an intern we haven't seen yet? It's like,
yeah, exactly. Those people typing in the background of the post office, you know, they're poor people having to put together all these files. So we didn't want anybody to read them and feel like it got boring.
And so. there was a really hopefully this comes across as well. We were very, very sort of strict on ourselves that there has to be a narrative logic as to all the images, you know, as much as possible.
Oh, yeah.
So for example, you know, if there's going to be the shot of Red as there is, you know, when he's at the top of the show, when he kneels down, puts his hand behind his head, that needs to have a treatment like it's from a security camera. We need to sort of make sure that if this was one of our rules as well. Where was Liz? That was one of the rules.
Yeah.
Where was Liz? Did Liz became aware of it, then she could do a comment on it. But there was a bunch of stuff in the dossier which we narratively said, no, we can't include that because Liz wasn't
never
there.
Never saw it,
Or Liz didn't find out about it through Red.
Yeah.
So that was, again, we kind of had one of those walls like in the war room. It was just this crazy like a collection of, how does that work? Does that break our rule? Does that break our narrative rule? And it's important to do that.
Yeah, which is why you'll read her in the little notes at the bottom of the files, you know, saying, questioning something about why Red did something. And if you watch the show, you're like, I know why Red did that. And you're like, but she wouldn't know why Red did that.
Exactly.
So we wanted to really make sure that when you're reading it, it's definitely from her perspective. So mysteries that we as an audience may have been revealed to
we're
not revealed to her are also not revealed to her in the copy of the book.
Yeah.
Well, and a great example of that is the Stewmaker section for the Blacklister file, because she's starting out and she's writing in these in bullets, right? And you get to the Stewmaker, and all of a sudden the bullets are gone, and it's written kind of in a third person, and that makes total sense, because like she's really going to do a case report after she's just been kidnapped, tied to a chair, shown this acid bath. So it makes perfect sense on why someone else would be writing that case report for her on her behalf.
Oh,
that's great to hear. <That's awesome. laughs> This makes us very happy. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much. Yeah. And then we also put, you know, some Easter eggs in. So if look at any of the case files and you look at the numerics for it, look at them and figure out what they would mean.
Look at them very closely, the case file numbers.
Case file numbers and stuff.
There's some things in there which hopefully fans, and we haven't seen anyone online analyze it yet, but maybe someone will, maybe after this show.
How about you just tell me, and then you you can tell me after the show, and Troy can spend all week trying to figure it out.
Tell you,
exactly.
Well, what I thought was there was actually one nugget, and I had to ask, because you guys did the Lost Encyclopedia, and I do not remember off the top of my head because it was season one, but in the Freelancer case file, it talked about how, you know, Kimberly Bermwood was on the train that was crashed and she had this assassination hit put on her. but in the notes, you guys put that she sat in seat 23B. Was that from the show, or was that like an add-in from you guys?
Oh, I don't know. What do you think? It's
like, I know somebody else that sat in 23B on some other show.
Yes, I don't know.
There were some. There were some additions, that little things, in case you know. Yeah. If you're a crossover fan of some of the things that we do, there's things.
It's a lot of, we get to have some fun with this stuff, and it's just that's adds another layer of enjoyment to the project, because you can get meta beyond meta.
Yeah, and just have fun with it. On some of those details that are never going to have an impact on the rest of the show.
Yeah.
We were allowed to do some things like that, so. Yes, we'll say if you caught things like that, then you were very smart.
I smiled at that one.
I'm sure you did. You know what you should do is, for all the Disillusioned Lost fans, people were like, man, I hated the ending. You should tell them that your next three books, whatever the ones you're trying to sell the most, that there are clues to the true ending of the island in each one, and you will sell tons. I guarantee it.
That's a good point.
That is a good point.
It's so funny though, because the friends of ours that found out way back when we were doing, when it was announced, there was a San Diego Comic-Con event for the encyclopedia. Naturally, you've got friends and family going, wait, so this is going to explain everything? And we were like, no. And actually, we really, really love the foreword that Damon and Carlson wrote for the encyclopedia, because they summarize what the show is, the mysteries of the show, like why certain things would never be answered, and then also what this book is. And how that it's not a place to come to for answers. The mystery should remain mysterious, and that's why it's called Lost. And it's this brilliantly written foreword where we went to each other like, great, okay, the foreword is brilliant. It's like, that explains what the book is. We don't have to answer people saying, why don't you explain the Flash sideways or the fence?
I know, yeah. It wasn't an encyclopedia as in like a scientific document that explains everything. It's just, hopefully it just tried to lay out everything.
And it's, as we always said, you know, it's what you see the show. There are definitely Easter eggs in that as well that are like fun things, but they don't betray the mystery of the show, and it's that's exactly what it should have been.
Well, let me ask you a question in terms of when you're doing these books, when you're putting these collections together, and you're trying to get them ready for the fans, who the fans eat this stuff up. Fans love stuff like this because they're so sucked into this world. The fact that they can continue the world when the show's over, it just makes their heart beat faster or something. But how important is it to you, or how important do you think it is, that when you're working on these, that you're actually a diehard fan of the show? Like, do you have to be a rabid fan of the show to put one of these together, do you think? It's kind of a tougher question. I'm just curious if you have to be.
You know, I was actually talking to one of my editors from a previous book yesterday, and it's funny because the thing is, there's so much wonderful television out there right now that I wish I didn't have to work to pay for rent and things like that to watch as much awesome television as there is. I have a frightening backlog of shows that I know I will love, but that I just don't have time to watch right now because I'm working on the other stuff that we're doing. And what we end up doing though is We try to, if somebody had come to both of us, or we both write individually these books as well sometimes, and pitched a show that, let's say it was like seven seasons into it, and I had never watched that show, mm-hmm. I would recommend somebody that I know in my field to take it.
Yeah.
Because I feel like, especially with, if somebody had ever given me a Buffy book, man, I'd have been on that like amazingly. I would have like, I wasn't watching that show for the details, but I had like a Buffy encyclopedia in my head, and an Angel encyclopedia in my head. So if somebody had come to me towards the end of those runs, I could have jumped out of that book and been fine.
Yeah.
But there's so many mythology-based television shows, mm-hmm. that if I feel, and I know I kind of guide my choices on this, I have to have watched some of it,
yep.
like it, and really know that I can service the show well. And if it is way down the track and I feel like somebody else could do a better job, I would just be afraid to create a book that I think would sell it short. And I, regardless of how deeply we're into a show, when we take on a show or a movie property, man, we watch them over and over and over. We both do our own set of notes, then we cross compare with each other's notes. He might be taking notes for, looking at it one way, and I'm looking at the notes a different way. And then we'll go, okay, when we look at having to write, one of the episode entries as a case file, we use both of each other's notes, and we, put them together to make sure that we haven't missed anything or the perception was wrong. So we kind of regardless become, even if we liked the show, we have to become super experts on the show when we say yes. And we enjoyed The Blacklist from the beginning, but you know, we weren't watching it like we had to watch it to write a book about
it. Yeah, it's kind of like an emotional reaction. It's or that's the scale. It's like if we feel we can service the show, but we really love what the show does, that definitely is a big factor. I mean, you know, that we're very, very lucky, the fact that all the books we put out as duos, these are shows that spoke to us a lot, yeah. that really felt like, obviously going back to Lost and Fringe, and we did for the first two seasons of Sleepy Hollow, which was like, we love all the prosthetics on that show, and that show was really, really jiving in the first like season and a half especially. So
yeah, I think you got them out in time too.
it's a peculiar situation with that show. I think that's the way of putting it. Yeah. But in terms of like what that show was doing the first two seasons, and especially the artistry behind that show, oh my goodness, we were huge fans of what that show was doing, and so that was a real joy to put all the monsters and the sculpts and all the kind of prosthetic stuff to get it in a book, mm-hmm. and then that came The Blacklist, and it was like. We feel very fortunate we get to switch gears so quickly between doing a Fringe book to a Sleepy book to this hardcore spy espionage thriller, mm-hmm. twists and turns and things, and much more like a real world rather than a genre show.
Yeah, but it hit our genre feels and our like from Alias. It
oh my like, goodness! That. Yeah, the Alias.
And then it hit like the mythology stuff of like, you know, of like Fringe, and you know, certainly not as hardcore deep, but it was a deep dive, making sure that we made sure that. Everything that Red had said and what connected to this and what connected to that, because, you know, the show just gave us scripts, you know, they didn't have,
there's no show Bible,
another, so, there's no yeah, Bible yeah. for the show. So we really had to make sure that we could dig into it. And we've had other opportunities that have come across where we felt, I don't know if we're the right people for that, but you know, we know this person that knows it so
yeah,
well.
We passed them stuff. And you know, myself personally, Tara is as well, but I'm a massive like crime noir fan and things like from the comics, from like the Brubaker comics through to, you know, the classic films. So for me, the Reddington world really taps into that vein as well. And having an opportunity to do a book on a show that has that atmosphere was brand new. It was like we hadn't really dug deep
yeah,
into
it was
that,
really fun.
Which is really, really fun to do.
So what was it like for you guys writing this? Because you'd done the two previous books with Lost and Fringe. More as like the final thoughts or wrap up to it, where this is kind of like in mid-flight. Are you looking forward to maybe doing more in-flight stuff with The Blacklist?
Yeah, honestly,
yeah, definitely.
Really
it was a really great experience, and you're right to say to ask what it was like, because it was very different. You know, this was really first two seasons of a show, and just getting towards its third. And I think we really loved the whole challenge of capturing the character's voice, and we worked really hard on that. When we were watching or rewatching the show hundreds of times over, we really made loads of notes on just the kind of the way that Liz talks at different points, you know, when she's feeling emotional about something, or when yep. she's angry about something, when she's feeling like vulnerable about something. So we tried to really capture that character, which, you know, is so difficult to do because the writing on the show is so good. So we really felt a responsibility to make sure we were combing back through the scripts, looking how Liz's language comes across and things not to do. So yeah. we kind of had like a rule book of how the things that, even with drafts with each other, saying, no, Liz wouldn't quite say it in that way. She'd probably lean more towards saying it in this way. So that was a really good challenge.
Yeah, we read each other's work. And we kind of split up the cases equally yeah. between each other. And then once finished, we'd give it to the other person and then we'd read it and we would just kind of act like each other's, our guidelines for, no, like maybe that should be said differently. That I don't think she would. Yeah, exactly. Like he said, just kind of pulling back with Liz, making sure she doesn't show her emotions very often, especially just certain instances. So like you mm-hmm. said, it would have to be a case where she was allowed to have a moment where she was really had an emotional impact and, you know, either said something to Red or what to one of her colleagues. That was a moment, you know, or if she registered something with Wrestler and you could see in her performance, you know, that was, you know, something that she was kind of reaching out to him, then she could write it in more of an yeah. emotional place. But we really made sure that it had to tie in with performance, with, how much Liz allows of herself to be known, which is a lot less than you expect sometimes. And just making sure that we really stayed true to where she was in an episode. And
having that, like, that almost like the final draft of or the final, like, copy pass would be, you know, reminding ourselves of the context, you know, because this isn't a novel going out in her voice. You know, this is her combing through hardcore reports of things and her making notes.
It's her profiler part of her.
Yeah, so absolutely. And so how much would she reveal to the person who might be reading this as it's a fail-safe document? You know, some of it maybe captures a moment where she's feeling particularly despairing about something, or other points she might be more measured, more calculated about how she phrases something. So there's a lot of nuances to it, but that's what we love that stuff. We love having that kind of different challenges for writing. So.
And it also had an earlier release date, but we were really concerned that if it came out at that point, like I had said before, that fans would feel like the book was old before it hit the shelf. And so we really did push the show and our publishers to say, can we push the release date a little bit so that we really can include half of season three in this, so that as a fan, you don't feel like, again, we're so concerned about the fan experience of spending, you know, $30 on a hardback coffee table book, that you don't feel like you were cheated and going like, well, why am I buying something from season one and two when we're already at the end of almost season three? So, you know, print has its problems. We're not the internet. You know, we can't turn around and go like, it's printed in 6 weeks. You know, it just doesn't work that way. But we really just stayed with the show. Every time a script was released for season three, we were on it, we read it, and then we'd immediately start writing so that we could send things to our publishers and then our designers could start doing it. We didn't have episodic photography for the season three episodes.
Because it literally didn't exist yet.
They hadn't released it yet for any online or print facilities. They, you know, take a little bit longer and sometimes take closer to release dates for those episodes for them to come out. So that's why you'll see in the season three things that it's a lot of interpretations of where she is.
Which works so well because, you know, Liz is on the run. And so you're not going to have the same level of case file information, pictorial information. It will have to be things that are much scrappier, that might be caught on a cell phone or might be doodled down on a bit of paper.
Yeah, or diner paper or things
so
like that.
We love to have it really supported the narrative of the book so well.
So it was fun, it was stressful, but we feel like it made the book better, you know, just at least from a fan perspective, you know, because again, you know, we're the people that buy these books too. So we felt like, you know, it was trying to stay within what our parameters were, work with the assets that we were going to have and troubleshoot around that. And then really from there, try to make sure that it made sense to where the story was.
It was great to be able to dovetail the elements of the Blacklister story in that into the dossier, so that it all feels a part of the same universe.
And that was nice because, you know, we had access to the Titan comics, you know, before they got released. So we were reading her scripts and we could, you know, again, know what would Liz know, what would Liz not know, you know, if Red is telling the story.
What does she know? We want to know. What does she know?
Exactly. So if Red's talking about something and it's an all Red issue, she would not know any of that. So, you know, just making sure we would excise what needed to be excised and use what we could.
And, you know, you guys are huge fans of the show, but can you just imagine it? You know, we're near the end of this book and episode 303 drops in as a script. And although we're excited to read it, every time we were terrified, going, is there going to be some amazing plot twist that's going to make us phone our publisher and go, hey, so we've got some news.
You're so screwed.
There's like, there's a robot that's turned up. Like, how do we? So we're always like just reading like cautiously and excitedly, and then getting towards the end of a script and going, that's amazing. Because, you know, I'm sure you guys agree, season three is such an amazing season, and it's probably the season that the show is like finest so far.
We love how twisty and explosive it is. Her on the run, you know, being able to document that was really
so much
fun. The show really, you know, changed its whole format for the first half of season three. That it felt like it really worked for what we were doing, but it was just really fun to write outside of, you know, what was the normal, you know, kind of procedural aspect of the show that really dominated season one and two.
That was fun, and fans were up and down over everything. It seems like everybody's got a different want and need. So, I mean, it was a great year for to be a fan of the show, because anytime you get those heightened emotions, because people react completely differently, especially on the internet. And it was just great seeing it explode, both good and bad.
yeah, you know, you're invested, and it's you know, we literally watched the second half of the season like everybody else again, you know,
which was so much fun.
So it was all surprises for us, and we, you know, had our own conjectures about what was going to happen, and, you know, we're not going to bug the show and go tell us, you know, it's just like, well, okay, we're watching, and you know, always thinking, well, what can we pitch next, you know, for if they wanted to do something else. So yeah,
but it was fun. Those real neck wrenching twists that happened in the back end, you know, the twice over especially. It was fun just reaching out to Nicole and going, what? and having an email back going, gotcha. And we're like, what on earth's going on? And then of course, the very end of the season, doing the same reaction as well and just saying, oh my God, you guys killed it. Yeah, it was so great. Fun.
Oh, I mean, it's one of those seasons where I know a lady and she's normally sane, but near the end of the season, she was talking to me like the characters were real. And they're not actors playing characters. So she's like, what? I mean, do you think so-and-so's dead? Do you, what do you think's going to happen? Like, I think they're fine. It's the character might come back. Yeah, but they're fine. They're fine. They're probably off having a margarita right now. I don't know.
Very calmly say, I think they're on hiatus and they're on a beach. And we're not talking metaphorically, like yes, some kind of halfway like purgatory. No, they're actually on an actual beach. Enjoying a cocktail, and everything's good in the world. It's all good. Yeah.
So let's talk about one of the more controversial things of the season. There seems to be this polar opposite. John talked about it last week on the interview. Mr. Tom Keene himself. You guys devote an entire section to Tom Keene.
Yes, I know. And boy, do we hear about that from somebody else.
Do you? Good and bad, I would imagine?
Yeah, it was, you know, there's
funny, isn't it?
For the people that really are about, you know, Reddington and Liz in the show, you know, we always just look to see what the general chatter is. You know, we try to push the books as much as possible, so people know what's out there. And so we'll do searches just on, you know, chatter about if it comes up on any social media or whatever. And Tumblr had a lot of conversations. People that were way over the Tom Keene part of it, and were like, you know, even some people that were like, I'm not buying this book, there's too much Tom Keene, he gets a tab. And I actually, you know, like, you know, never read your comments,
never jump into
the crazy, you know, the rabbit hole of fandom. Sometimes you just need to let them breathe through it. But I just did say, guys, the context of how we did Tom is going to totally make sense to you. You will get why he's got a tab. The whole book is Reddington. It's just Tom has a special one because she's trying to figure him out.
But that was actually the funniest one. As far as saying, it's like the people saying, wait, they don't care about Reddington. He doesn't have a tab. And we're like, the entire book is Reddington.
It's Reddington. It's like he is a tab.
It's like, it's like, you know,
front tab, end tab, close the book.
It's not an accident that, you know, her comments about Reddington are written in red. It's like, it's you know, there's he lives, and is the presence of him is echoes throughout every Blacklister in the entire book. So, and we felt if there was a version of the book where another set of authors went, oh, we'll do this book, and there'll be a tab on Reddington, that makes no sense, because the whole show is
Reddington, the whole book, so. In our mind, is her trying to figure it out still.
Yeah.
You know, everything that he's not telling her, she is going, how can I figure it out on my own? And her, you know, trying to draw all of those strings together and put it in a place where, you know, when she had her wall and then had to, you know, put it kind of in this space, she's still trying to figure out all of those things. And then, you know, her own history and what she's learned and what she can glean. And so, yeah, I mean, Reddington is front and center to
Absolutely.
All of that. So yeah, we got some initial pushback, but then, you know, some of those people bought the book and then, you know, responded afterwards and went, yeah, okay, thank you. You know, we really appreciate Red's, you know, presence in the book. And we were like, yeah.
But it's that weird, okay. I think it's that weird, there's just a weird short-term attention span thing. Like, to put it politely, and to underestimate it by 1,000 of internet reactions, which is just, it still to this day blows me away. And that's why I'm an old analog dude, I think. It's just, even just seeing like a screen grab of seeing a tab and going, oh my God, like the worst writers ever. They've given Tom Keene a tab. I just want to, I don't know, I don't have any reaction to it because it just baffles me. I'm not even angry. I'm just like, I don't get it.
I think a lot of people watch this show from a shipper point of view, And so, you know, everybody kind of that you're coming at it from a point of view with that. And, you know, we looked at it from, okay, her shipper point of view as she's writing it would be that, you know, she was married to Tom. And so she's trying to figure that aspect, the web of lies. we didn't really, you know, there was no agenda from the show or ourselves to ever say we have to write it from a place where we're, you know, fan fictioning how she feels about Tom or Red or anything. It was just, we were really, really hardcore, make it performance, script, and what we saw, you know, and just making sure that that translated without a subtext. But you still then also saw people that would read things and go like, oh, see, they totally mean this. And like they were reading into it going like, see, they're with us. And I'm going, okay.
Hashtag runaway. Just runaway.
It happens every episode. Don't feel bad.
We totally know that.
But it's so funny, right? Because obviously the Tom character is like a massive part of the show in terms of like from the very beginning of the show and her relationship with this guy and all the twists and turns. So for us, it was like, hang on, if there's an Elizabeth Keen dossier in her voice investigating all the crazy stuff that's happened in her life, yeah, there's going to be a section because, you know, she talked to the guy for information for like, there's going to be a section where she's processing who is this stranger in my life. But you're absolutely right. You will never win. You'll never win. It's like, you can't please everybody.
Yeah. So. I mean, the reviews have been very nice because I think that, you know, it's that people have just registered the kind of,
I think the ones that read it have been
yeah, I think they have. Yeah. You know, I think that's it. And, you know, I think it'd be a more complicated book, you know, if we did do all of season three, you know, once you really started getting into the
I don't know how that would work.
It wouldn't have technically worked. So it like kind of finished at its
back. There'd be like chapters with nothing, just blank pages.
It would be like, she'd be, you know, at her little, her hideaway, crocheting or something, you know, it would be.
Yeah.
Now, is there a plan maybe for in the future to do it from Red's point of view?
Well, you know, we're happy that John really liked the book, and you know, ultimately it's, you know, totally based on how well the book does in terms of sales, and then in terms of how long they're going to continue with the storyline to like kind of back a book. You know, I think if we were to do it, we probably wouldn't want to repeat everything that we had done with Red's eyes, but we certainly could, you know, depending on where the storyline goes, and the storyline is always so complicated and interesting, and there's all this other stuff, which is, you know, they're obviously mining it in the comic book too, that we don't get to see, that there are definitely a lot of places that it could go. And usually, you know, with publishing, they like to give it like two seasons between books to kind of like with my 24 books, they were two seasons together. I'm doing an Outlander book right now, which is seasons one and two. So they like this kind of clustering of at least two seasons together. So, you know, based on the second half of three, we probably would, you know, have another year before, and we'd see where that storyline would go before we do something else.
It really depends on what, you know, what the show wants ultimately. You know, if John and his team feel like further down the line, there's another avenue to explore this world in a book form, you know, we'd be honored. We had a great time doing this one for them, and it's just
And there's all the people in the post office, you know, so there's plenty of other perspectives,
loads of
that could be done. I think they like
I want to do an Aram one.
Aram one,
Do an Aram playlist book where it's nothing but playlists from Aram.
All over that. Sign me up. Yeah.
Aram, all of his little secrets, you know, him smoking that blunt in the seat in the funeral episode. I did not know. It was like
he's awesome.
You just immediately start thinking of all the fun ways that you could describe and talk about and reveal things. But
I agree with Tara. It would be really fun to have a completely different kind of book, a different perspective entirely. You know, maybe it's something even redemption.
Yeah,
based. You know,
exactly.
That's a whole
and that's it too. You know, you're gonna
so much to come.
You have all that new mythology coming with that show, and if it makes it past a year, you know, that's, you know, a show has to live a year for publishing and licensing for it to really kind of jump. And so that does really well next year. That's a whole other avenue that the guys could, you know, say, hey, what do you guys have an idea wise about what you could do with Tom and his story, and certainly, you know, how they're going to wrap up what the disconnection link is going to be between him and Liz and his daughter. You know, that might be fodder for a lot of cool story too.
Yeah.
That would live it well in a publishing sense. So
you could do an entire like teen novel series about Tom's life at St. Regis.
Totally happened.
Do you know what? It's probably already happened. There's a fan fiction website out there. You know,
probably has done a fabulous job.
Yeah,
with
it's
that,
already
exactly.
there. It's already done.
Probably is. Now you've got some other stuff coming up. Let's talk about that a little bit, including one of my favorite movies of all time, and I'm not just joking. I mean that. Big Trouble in Little China is a huge favorite of mine. It's a cult movie. A lot of people don't know what it is, but John Carpenter did it in the 80s, starring Kurt Russell, and I couldn't even explain it if I tried. But you guys are trying to, you're doing a book, actually two books, right? An art book and a making of book.
Yeah, it's a making of book. We love that movie a lot, and we both have our own, we both as kids watched that movie. I watched it with my mom, and we like adored that movie, and Paul watched it with his brother, and it was just, you know, one of those movies that stays with you, and we're always just looking for new properties, and whether it's, we do a lot of current, you know, so if it's a movie or it's a TV show, but there's obviously, we're hitting that sweet spot of where the 80s films are really, you know, hitting their 30th anniversaries. So we, a year ago, you know, not this past January, the one before it, we're just doing what we normally do, which is a huge brainstorming session and looking at calendars and seeing what movies were, you know, rotating in terms of big years, and talking to our licensors, which is great because we have really great relationships with several of the licensors, and seeing, you know, what they already had in the pipeline and if they'd given it to other people. And Big Trouble, you know, we're like, God, that would be so much fun just because the visuals of that, and it's like underappreciated. And it's only really like around that same time that they started actually doing licensing around that movie with Funko and their reaction and their pops. And it's not something that's like you said, it's not something that's been touched on as in like it's a cult movie. Yeah. And so we went to Fox and said, we'd love to do this. And they were like, yes, that is fantastic. And publishing company that's been they do a lot of great comic books, and they had the license with John Carpenter, because John Carpenter was helping them develop what they were going to do with that comic book series. And so it took a year of us working to develop that, but we got the yes to do it. And it has just been like a pinch me moment all the time working on all the who we've gotten and what the materials that we've gotten for that movie. We're just like beside ourselves, nerd geek, like squeeing, as you said earlier, like we just look at each other and go, how do we get here? This is so cool.
And to keep it a surprise as well, we'll just say, if you think about the kind of people that you'd like to read brand new interviews with from the cast and crew, don't worry, we've got you covered.
Yeah.
So it's like, we've really deep dived on this film, and we were so lucky to get to go to the Fox archives and uncover some things which haven't seen the light of day in 30 years.
Yeah, literally
have
years.
Been kept in drawers.
Like, we had gloves on. That's how cool this was. Like, we were like, we're touching this stuff,
yeah.
And it hasn't been touched in 30
and
years.
And some amazing, you know, artistic things, should we say, that we uncovered, which, you know, talking to our licensor and talking to our publisher and saying, we could do a section on this, and then going, yes, do that. And then, you know, getting in touch with the visual effects company that were involved with the movie and finding out that they had a personal archive, which those photos have never seen the light of day. So we really went to town with this one, and we're very excited to get this one out there.
We're so if you're a fan, and you know, like, again,
we hope you enjoy it.
Fan of this movie. It, we quote it. It's one of those movies that you put on, and like you said, there's a generation now, millennials, that probably have never heard of it unless they accidentally clicked on it on Netflix. But man, it, you know, for so many of us that grew up in the 80s, it's in that, if you love the Goonies and Aliens and, you know, like, it just is all in that kind of same time frame. And it's, you know, John Carpenter's last studio film. And it's the film that also was kind of really different than all the dark things that he was doing, you know, had really showed his sense of humor and showed Kurt Russell's sense of humor and was just really progressive. And so it's the great thing is we've just been loving what we get to do with it from a fan perspective, but there's a lot of resonance with this film 30 years later. It's
very much so.
It feels like a throwaway movie, but when you think about the Asian cast and how progressive it was with a lot of things that it was doing, and you know, how ahead of its time it was in terms of portrayals we are still not caught up on this movie. It's, I think people will be really surprised if you come into it looking at it like, I just love that movie. It made me laugh. And then when you really kind of read the perspective of it. It's gonna might surprise some people.
Yeah, there's some really great, you know, heartfelt stories and funny stories in the book, which, you know, captures all those different elements to it. And one thing we were asked the other day, which we really want to assert, because someone assumed something incorrectly, and they mentioned the dreaded R word, and they mentioned the remake, and yeah, they said, "Oh, is this happening because of the remake?" And we were like, "How many times can we say no? No, yes. No. We love this film so much, and we pitched it, as Tara was saying, you know, in January 2015, and that's when it got picked up as a concept to do. So way before any, you know, firm.
Yeah, it was even before. Yeah, I think that announcement had happened.
Yeah,
and since then, you know, people. Even people that we've interviewed have said, "Is it because of it?" And we're like, "No."
And, you know, we said,
"Just because of you and this movie existing."
Yeah. And we're going, you know, we've been record before and said, no one needs that. No, I don't want to see it happen. And that's said with no animosity to anyone involved with the remake. It's just the fact that we don't need it in our lives because Big Trouble in Little China exists. It already exists. It's amazing.
It's timeless. It still stands
up.
You know,
an amazing film. We don't need another one.
Yeah,
we don't need
exactly
a copy of it. So
yeah, we hope that. When you crack open that book, that you get a huge smile on your face, like we've had making it. So.
Oh, I'm just hearing about it, it's got a big smile. Troy and I actually, we talked about how would you remake it when that was announced not too long ago. And, you know, we decided that the only way you could do it is just go to space. That's literally the only way you could do it. Just be absolutely ridiculous because there's no way you could redo it here on Earth. And The Rock, I just don't see how he could do, I don't think he could do what Kurt Russell did, which is, make a guy look as incompetent as humanly possible, and you still root for him the entire time.
Exactly. And, you know, certainly Kurt looked a fine looking specimen then, and has never changed in terms of being a fine looking specimen. But Jack was not this monster jacked looking guy like The Rock is. You know, the great part about Jack is that he's wearing a hoodie and jeans and, you know, a wife beater, and he's completely clueless the entire time. He doesn't look that much outside of what you would figure a truck driver would look like. And that's why when he's in any of those situations with, you know, the alley fight, or when he's in, you know, the hells, you know, underground of Lopan's, you know, estate, you're like, okay, you totally get that he's vulnerable in a way. But I would never buy that if The Rock was in the middle of that alley fight with the, you know, the two warring clans, that he would like knock people's heads over and walk through them like Moses parting the water. You know, I think there's a visual there that you just kind of go, I lost the concept because
I think that's it. Yeah.
He's too big.
I don't think it's been thought through.
Yeah. I mean, he's got the sense of humor. Like, I get that he has a sense of humor, and he's, you know, that translates really well. And he's certainly played on that so much more in the last, you know, couple of years of movies that he's done. But I also there's something to be said about the physicality and you buying that Jack Burton character walking into a situation where he's completely over his head. Like, that's so important to that character because he is a buffoon and he's not the hero of the story.
Well, that's it. And I was going to say, I'll just say this because I'm assuming it is still going ahead, and I still hope it doesn't. I genuinely mean that. But if it,
well, The Rock's in every movie that's being made right now. So
if it does end up being released and it exists, I just hope that they don't miss what the film is, as in, you know, as Tara was saying earlier, that Wang's the hero. Wang gets the girl. So I hope they don't, you know, pivot and have it be about, you know, The Rock playing a Jack Burton type character and have him be the hero. Because that would just completely negate the entire movie, which, you know, he's claimed he loves. So,
Yeah.
It's literally like the movie an American filmmaker wanted to make an Asian film, but the only way they could make it is if they cast an American lead. And he's like, well, fine, but he'll be a dimbulb.
Exactly. Okay.
And John Carpenter, you know, has always like loved all these martial arts movies. So it's like it's his love letter to those. And it's like that's why it's just, you know, some of the crew we spoke to during the interviews have summed it up so well. You know, they said that it's what John does in that movie as a director, what Kurt does in that movie, and what everybody brings from their point of view to the film, from cast and crew, if you take all those elements away, you don't have Big Trouble in Little China. That's how, like, precious and lightning in the bolt it is. So if you remove all those elements and just say, well, we'll just remake it, well, you can't. It's a real lightning in the bottle movie.
Because for years, the other part of it is that it was considered a failure because people didn't get it. It was... Mm-hmm. really progressive in terms of what it was doing with its hero, what it was doing with, you know, it, again, bringing in an entire genre of cinema that, unless you were an Asian cinema fan, this was like, what am I seeing here? And then mixing that with humor. So, you know, it was, the critics didn't get it. You caught, like, two major critics got it, and everybody else was like, I don't understand what this is doing. And it's one of those films that it needed to ruminate and people needed to watch it. And it was, you know, it pretty much became successful as soon as it hit the home video market. But that was, you know, a year after it had been considered and called and Bean Counter established as a big fat failure, you know. And John, even to this day, is like, it's so weird to me because, you know, you just move on when you're a filmmaker. He moved on to other independent movies and all the other myriad of other things that he does. You don't sit there and look back at it and feel depressed about it. You know, every day you got to move forward and do the next creative thing you're going to do. And he did that, but it's really illuminating to him how much 30 years of people really adoring this film, how much that's grown and how much of a tidal wave that was in the year after, you know, it came out, and since that it's really fun to watch him talk about it and hear other people talk about it. And you still see him kind of not processing that in the most kind of charming and you want to hug him kind of a way.
this one is very special to us because we clocked it the other day. We were talking about, you know, the books we've done so far to this point and the magazines we've been involved with, but it's like, wait a second, this is a movie we watched as kids. So this is a different experience. Yeah. This is the first time we're doing a book that's a 30th anniversary. So it's a completely different feeling. Yeah. And we feel very grateful that this is a very special one to us.
Yeah.
Well, I can't wait to see it. And for people that are Blacklist fans, get the dossier. For people that want to get Big Trouble in Little China, you can pre-order it now on Amazon. So be sure to do that.
Should be out end of August for that one. And yes, the Blacklist dossier, if you like it.
If you're missing the show.
We'd love for you to, you know, it certainly fills hiatus time. And, you know, the more support there is, we opens the door for, you know, anybody, even if it's not us, these kinds of products around a TV show to still be made. You know, that's ultimately how things get made around the show is when people show up for it.
Absolutely.
So, you know, whether it's buying stuff off the NBC store or giving our book a try, and certainly Nicole's comic books and stuff, that all makes ancillary licensing happen. And, you know, that's, you know, we're just very proud to have been able to work within the world and are very grateful when anybody says, yeah, you know, we're going to pick that up.
And, you know, we're joking about fan reactions to things like the Tom section, but we genuinely love hearing fans' reactions to the stuff that we do. So, you know, anyone listening who loves The Blacklist who has read the book or is thinking of reading the book, we'll retweet reviews and things or comments you've made and stuff. Cause it's just great to see the hardcore fans seeing how they're reacting already to the content. Because, you know, that's what we really worked hard to make sure that they're happy. Because it's not for us, it's for, you know, it's for the fandom.
No, and we really appreciate it because, I mean, as people that have loved the show, we've seen the Buffy magazine. I've gotten the 24 books. I'm a huge Jack Bauer fan. Go Jack! I Lost Encyclopedia, Fringe. Those are huge in Troy's world. I'm still kind of iffy on that ending, but with Lost, But Troy, I mean, he's an insane Fringe and Alias fan. Like, I don't know, what's your level? Are you one of the nutty ones? Are you like that lady that doesn't know that the characters are fake, Troy?
Pretty close.
I miss Alias a lot. I that was one of my favorite magazines to work on. I love that. I love that cast and crew. I love the ABC team. The Bad Robot team was so great to work with for that magazine. And yeah, I was thinking about it the other day when there's been some articles about the 10th anniversary since the finale, and it sort of brings it all back. That was a really, again, a very special, you know, magazine to be involved with, and just in terms of how much a fan I was of that show. It was one of those kind of film scene moments where my boss came out into the the bullpen of the magazine department and said, "Anyone here watching Alias?" And, you know, a lone hand goes up and it's mine. And he's like, "Oh, well, can you pop in here?" So what popped in. He's like, "Yeah, well, kind of got the license to show." And I was like, "Yeah, I'll run that." And he was like, "Oh, okay, done." Because he didn't care. He didn't care about the show at all. He knew nothing about the Rambaldi thing. Didn't think there was anything genre about it at all. He was like, "Why are we doing this show? You know, it's a spy show."
Oh, so you kind of played it off like, oh, yeah, I got this. That's fine. Sure.
Oh, no, I was like, it's not just a spy show. He's like, no, it's not just a spy show. Like, no, it's not just a spy show. So we did that for a bit. And then, you know, fast forward to me obsessively trying to make that magazine in the same way as, you know, I guess as an echo to what, you know, me and Tara love doing with our book stuff, is that I always wanted that magazine, especially because the world that populated, to be a long read for a reader. I wanted them to buy that magazine and spend 2 months poring over all the little box outs and all the kind of hidden information about Rambaldi and all those characters. Yeah, man, I'm gonna say this. I'd bring that back in a heartbeat. If I had endless money and was like, let's bring back it's a movie or something, or, you know.
We both really adored Fringe, but we're happy that at least got a final season. You know,
yeah,
it was a lot of shows, especially if you're a genre fan, you don't get closure, which is a really horrible, sad thing. And so for Fringe to have been at least picked up for a fifth season and have its own ending,
yeah,
which
Fringe is a very special show.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I would love to see those characters come back again in, you know, a Netflix movie or whatever they'd ever choose to do down the line. But I at least feel like that I got for a weird show that was really quirky and that, yeah, you know, never had, you know, even lost numbers in terms of people watching it. I was really grateful that that had an ending that, you know, got me in the heart.
Well, it literally shows the power of the fans, because it was the fans that really made season 5 happen. And we have to be careful because Aaron is still slowly trudging his way through.
I finally started it. Troy finally talked me into starting it. And I finally started Fringe. I'm through the second season, I think.
Okay.
Well, the fans, it's good you mentioned them, because we cannot say enough good things about the Fringe fans.
Yeah.
You know, there's, as we said earlier about Lost, you know, you have lots of different kinds of Lost fans. You get ones that, you know, want to kill you because you did the encyclopedia, because they're like, well, I wanted to do it. Like, doesn't work like that.
Or
you're wrong. Damon and Carlton didn't mean that forward. They were forced to write it. No, they wrote that. It's like, so Lost fandom's kind of a peculiar territory, and we love a lot of them, but a lot of them are a little frightening. But the Fringe fandom, completely across the board, the Fringe fandom are just this wonderful, altruistic,
kind,
super kind, you know, big hearts, always supportive of everything in that Fringe fandom. I genuinely, during that Twitter phase of the book, you know, about to come out and the announcement of the books, and we both had so much fun with that Fringe fandom.
Really,
it kind of
did.
It allowed you to, it want, you know, for me, especially as someone who loves the analog world, I was like drawn into that Twitterverse with the Fringe fandom because they're so great.
Yeah.
They're such a wonderful
and
group
they
of people.
Did with the hashtags and being able to, like, you know, get stuff trending, and like,
well,
they were really,
they were responsible for that. You know,
yeah,
the thing that can't be said, and, you know, enough, is the fact that we all take that for granted now, that hashtag is kind of what all shows do when they air. But that Fringe fandom, they really led the way with that.
Yeah.
They showed up a bunch of marketeers in a big way, going, look what we've done. We've made a show trend on Twitter on hashtags.
Yeah, doing it every week.
Absolutely.
And getting into that, you know, when that decision came down to it, and, you know, Joel went to go pitch the fifth season, that he had a story and he had a fandom behind him that, you know, used social media,
yep,
to the nth degree. And, you know, it was, yeah, that was it was a really beautiful thing to see and be,
yeah,
part of.
Yeah, it really was.
Yeah.
Really was.
That's special when you come up on Facebook on those, like, when you your memories on this day, and it's like, oh my gosh, I remember giving up my cover photo and my profile photo, and you had to, like, update everything every single week. And it's crazy.
It was awesome. Yeah,
yeah.
Fans made they would send us, you know, their picture that they had made for the week with the hashtag,
yeah,
and all of it. It was so much fun. It was really great.
Yeah, we had a good time with that.
That was a really special time. So yeah, I mean, it's really, I mean, we're fans, man. We're hardcore fans, and we're so honored and so grateful, you know, that people allow us to play in their playgrounds and, you know, do it with the eyes of somebody that we want to honor the things that we love and that we know everybody else loves, to that we can even do such a weird thing like we do.
Exactly.
We're really, really happy, yeah, and grateful for it.
Well, it's really cool you guys took the time to tell us how it's done, because I think a lot of people don't realize how much work actually goes into it. So we really do appreciate that.
Oh, thanks for letting us do it.
Thank
we
you for
it.
Yeah, having us on. It's such a great show you guys do. So thank you so much for having us on it.
Thank you.
Thank you guys for your time.
Thanks so much, guys.
We really appreciate it.
Well, what'd you think? Was that very cool or what? Yes, it was. I know you liked it. I hope you liked it. That's going to do it for this episode. Remember, we will be back next week with our fall TV preview, where we're going to talk about all the shows we're looking forward to in the fall.
as well as have a TV pilot battle royale. Yeah, what is the best TV pilot out there? I know a lot of people think, well, they know what it's got to be this show. And people always do that thing where they go, oh, it's this show, hands down. Well, it's not hands down, or other people wouldn't have any ideas. You know what I mean? So there's other options, and I'm looking forward to seeing what wins. Remember to join our Facebook group. We've got a group and a page. The page is kind of like just to throw out recent stuff. The group is for everybody to talk to each other. That's the Hollywood Outsider Facebook group, Facebook page. We're also on Twitter at @H_Outsider. And you can find other episodes, reviews, and other info at thehollywoodoutsider.com. And our email is always feedback@thehollywoodoutsider.com. I hope you guys enjoyed the interview. Remember, the next time you head to a theater or turn on your tele, buy popcorn.